Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I thought we'd start out a little political. It's hard not to be political nowadays, even if you are doing as many of my patients are doing, which is to say, not listening to the news, just kind of making like one of those three little monkeys. And I know certainly we're all covering our mouths sometimes at family gatherings and such, but without further ado, let me just tell you a little story. So once upon a time, there was Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and everyone pretty much was signed up with them as a contractor. That's to say, the doctors were signed up. Blue Cross and Blue Shield were true not-for-profits, and Wall Street was not allowed to participate in the Happy Forest. Then, an evil wizard whose initials were RR cast a spell on American healthcare. A great temple of thorn bushes, all tangled and difficult to get through, grew, inhabited furthermore by vampire bats in business suits, surrounded healthcare. And the modern era was born. Many new creatures called HMOs came into being and created narrow networks. They only allowed certain physicians into their HMOs and offered them very low payments, but a high volume in return. Many doctors signed up for HMOs in order to keep their patients. But alas, it was not enough. And as the rates grew lower and lower that the HMOs were willing to pay doctors, this drove doctors to band together to fight the low contract rates as a group. Solar doctors were just told, take it or leave it. They began to starve. Hospitals, too, reacted by binding together to deploy a counterspell against the thorn forest called market leverage. And community hospitals either joined into hospital corporations or died. Groups of doctors who only work in hospitals, like emergency room doctors and anesthesiologists, had to band together into armies and then fight for contracts. Some specialists, like neurosurgeons and radiation oncologists, could stay out of the armies and did just that. Other insurance companies were created by Wall Street, many, many more. And they contracted with anesthesia groups, and the in-network, out-of-network doctor pattern emerged and lives to this day. But there was a problem with this. People fell ill on weekends and holidays, but the armies of doctors didn't always have enough specialists. So often, two armies would alternate caring for the people in the hospital so that the emergency rooms and the operating rooms were covered 24/7 and staffed all the time. But because of in-network, out-of-network situations, if a person had insurance that limits coverage to only in-network doctors, and Ronald Reagan's spell allowed this, then the out-of-network doctor could come after the patient for the difference. The people suffered from this surprise billing. Some people were severely impacted financially by these surprise bills. Some began avoiding going to emergency rooms or doctors due to fear of another surprise bill. Eventually, the Yellow King and his counselors heard the people wailing and came forward with an attempt at a solution. Unfortunately, like many such counterspells, it did not think about how to not give more power to the corporations. So we're going to talk about, from here, what the King and his counselors want to do. The King and his counselors were very, very clear that they wanted the Senate to do something, and the Senate recently passed legislation that would prevent patients from having surprise bills and it pays out-of-network physicians at the medium of the in-network rates. But it did not include some important safeguards, such as network adequacy requirements, a independent, transparent database of rates, or a dispute resolution process. So, for example, some insurance companies would have a very small network. They could have just one anesthesiologist on staff who obviously can't work every day 24/7. And all the other anesthesiologists who are covering the hospital would have to accept those contract rates. If I were an evil insurance company, I might actually bribe somebody to take a lowball rate, and then everyone else by this law would be forced to take that rate. This gives insurance companies way too much power and essentially creates a situation where doctors will not be able to continue to work. Rural areas would particularly be impacted. Now, here in California, we are very progressive, and so we recently passed a surprise billing law very similar to the one, to the loopholes that are in the Senate law. And as soon as that law went into action, the insurance companies began driving tanks through the loopholes. Insurers across the state are canceling longstanding contracts with physician groups, ER groups, and anesthesiology groups, and imposing anywhere from 25 to 45% payment cuts. They don't need to contract with physicians at all. They can just pay the low rate that is in the law, which is about 125% of Medicare. You can't actually get a practice rolling and keep it rolling at 125% of Medicare. We have a system where people with more expensive commercial insurance that pay better rates are what keep the system running and keep Medicare from collapsing. As the insurer networks diminish, access to care is in serious, serious jeopardy. Now, let's talk about on-call physicians. These are doctors who essentially are on duty to go in the middle of the night and anesthetize someone. These are people who are filling in if someone's sick and who's covered, they have to go in and cover other doctors who are different insurance. Now, I just want to point out that if you call in a locksmith or a plumber on Labor Day weekend, you're not going to pay a bargain rate for their expertise. You're going to pay through the nose. And I'm not suggesting that we should be paying doctors through the nose to show up at 2 in the morning on Saturday night. We knew what we were getting into when we signed up. On the other hand, paying us less than what we need to continue our business and cover our overhead is not a good idea. Now, in New York, they have a different model. And the first thing it does is it protects patients from those surprise bills. That has to be a priority. There's a thing called a commercially reasonable rate, and insurers need to are required to pay that. And if the physician objects or the insurer objects, they can go to a conflict resolution like arbitration. But this is called baseball arbitration. The arbiter can only select either the physician's proposed charge or the insurer's proposed payment, and the loser pays. There's no negotiation. It's done online, takes 30 days, and costs about $300. This is not major arbitration that can cost thousands of dollars. The arbiter can only pick one number. It forces both sides to submit pretty reasonable rates that they could live with. But very few cases are going to arbitration. In New York, of the 7.5 million emergency department claims, only 849 have even gone to arbitration. Both sides are effectively incentivized to work it out, and the arbiter can look at criteria like how complex was the case, a physician's experience, a benchmark payment rate, and in New York they're using 80% of physician billed charges. Here in California, that would be a pipe dream. We'll never see 80% of billed charges, never have, never will. Thank you, King RR. Anyway, there's an entity called Fair Health, which basically prevents profiteering. It throws out the outlier charges, so the low balls and the high balls, and it creates a reasonable reasonable middle. This is working in New York. It's brought physician bill charges down by 13%, and it's gotten us out of the situation. This New York model needs to be where things go nationally. And if you are at all interested in medical politics, you'll understand why I took the time to tell you this little fairy tale. Now, I'd like to say that the fairy tale has a happy ending. Who knows if it actually will? We're going to move to our first news story. And the news story is a really, really jaw-dropping, important news story, because people are finally admitting, and this is at the High Science Proceeding of the National Academy of Science, so this is a journal that you don't get into easily, and this was an international study that basically explains chronic Lyme. Chronic Lyme is a very, very, how should I put this, controversial entity. People who have chronic fatigue syndrome or chronic pain related to treated Lyme disease are often treated as if they themselves are malingering or mental. You can measure inflammatory markers that persist in these individuals. It's as if their immune system was fighting something off, but there's nothing left to fight. And often they don't even have markers for most of the Lyme antibodies, maybe a couple of them, but not what you normally see in acute Lyme disease, where all of the markers that the CDC has advised are lighting up like, well, like fire alarms. What this international team found was that even after the Lyme bacteria has been killed and most of its antigens broken down, there is a coat molecule in its cell envelope. So all bacteria have a cell wall, you may remember, kind of like a plant. And there is a protein sugar molecule. It's very similar to the kind of molecule that we have on our red blood cells that gives us our blood type, or that we use for tissue matching. And this molecule does not degrade when the bacteria dies. It's been shown to be lingering in joint fluid, and it can elicit an ongoing immune response. In other words, antibodies to this PG molecule will show up. It's PGBB is what they've named it. They'll show pro-inflammatory cytokine production. Those are the chemical signals that you get when you're coming down with the flu. The achy, tired, yucky, brain foggy feeling. Particularly tumor necrosis factor A, that's always elevated in people with autoimmune disease. And these persist even after antibiotic treatment because you've killed the bacteria, but you haven't gotten rid of this PGBB. Now, they've given PGBB to mice in experimental models, and they often develop acute arthritis. And they are finding immunoglobulins against PGBB in serum. So these findings are the first to implicate a specific molecule in eliciting a chronic, persistent immune response after the bacteria has died, and ordinarily we would have expected all of the fragments of the bacteria to be cleared from the system. Now, they didn't check in the brain, but this, I think, is going to prove to be exactly what's going on in the brains of people who get post-Lyme fatigue syndrome. And there's a alternative medicine explanation about L-forms and different kinds of forms of the bacteria that I think is going to prove to be the three blind men and the elephant kind of solution. So it's not L-forms, it's ghosts of Lyme. It's Lyme ghost particles. But these ghost particles fool the immune system into thinking they're real, and the immune system attacks them and continues to attack them and continues to attack them. So if I were thinking about researching this, I'd wonder if this could be dialyzed. Could we filter this out of the person's blood? Could we find some way of breaking it down? Perhaps a proteolytic enzyme of some kind could we glom it up into a particle that would be engulfed, getting rid of it? In other words, how do we get the macrophages, the big eaters, to go and eat this? And thus, maybe we cause a transient gout attack-like syndrome, but then it's gone, it's done, and it's over. really interesting in terms of where this takes us on the therapeutic, but for those of you out there who have battled being thought to be malingering, this, I think, is really good news. We're going to drop into email mode right now. Christine from somewhere sent me a message regarding SIBO. My daughter, 40 years old, has been suffering for years with a digestive issue. After extensive testing, she was diagnosed with a hiatal hernia and through a breath test, a high level of methane bacteria. And presumably this was a timed breath test, Christine, in which multiple specimens were taken right after drinking a carbohydrate drink. That's usually how this is done. She has already tried elimination diets and various adjustments to her food for several months at a time. She's seen many specialists and incurred a debt as a result of her Medicaid limitations. Yeah, let's not get started on limiting Medicaid to the poorest, the working poor. Medications and a short dose of antibiotics have seemed to make it worse. It's so bad now that she can't sleep and has become seriously depressed. She has developed a hopeless attitude, and I'm very concerned about her deteriorating overall health. What can she do? Well, it certainly sounds like a diagnosis of SIBO has been made by the doctors. I'm expecting that the antibiotic they gave her was Xifaxamin, and that does not always work. Sometimes it induces a short period of remission in people, but often the disease comes roaring back in a month or two because you haven't gotten rid of the conditions that started it and perpetuated. Now, SIBO is where bacteria, it stands for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is SIBO. And it's such a pretty name for such a horrible thing. People suffer extreme bloating and abdominal pain and cramping after eating. There is a reason that people are getting SIBO. It's the bacteria should be killed and kept to a very low level in the small intestine. One of the primary things that does that is stomach acid. So people who have low stomach acid or high stress, which causes low stomach acid, often develop some degree of SIBO. There are other reasons too. People who have had surgery, particularly any kind of bariatric surgery, but also people who have had certain infections. SIBO becomes really chronic in most people with Crohn's disease because they develop little fistula, little bypass tracts between their colon and their small intestine. And until you tie those off and close them, which is very difficult to do, they will always have higher bacteria levels in their small intestines. And the bacteria up there produce gas as a result of digesting particularly sugars and other carbohydrates that we consume. So I think that's her situation. Plant antimicrobials can be very helpful. And I'm talking about things like oregano, tarragon, thyme, rosemary. There are plant bark extracts like pau d'arco. There's herbs like uva ursi. All of these things can be used to just kind of keep damp down the amount of bacteria. If the person's taking probiotics, I'll often treat them by stopping probiotics. I mentioned increasing stomach acid. You take stomach acid substitutes like betaine hydrochloride. You use things like apple cider vinegar. You try to get the levels really high. I always check people with SIBO for yeast and try to culture it out of their stool, because if they have yeast, then you know that you're going to have to be very careful with all carbohydrates, not just the ones that have the so-called FODMAPs. And yes, go to the Stanford, Google Stanford FODMAPs, and that's the best of the diets I've found. And go for about 3 weeks without eating any of those foods, doing all these other things. You can also get a prescription for a prescription drug called metoclopramide. The trade name for that back when it had one was Reglan, and it was used as an anti-heartburn drug, but it doesn't reduce stomach acid. What it does is increase motility. So it moves things through the small intestine, and it helps prevent the bacteria in the ascending colon, that right down there on the lower right where your appendix is, sometimes the ileocecal valve is a little bit loose and floppy. And so the bacteria can climb through that valve, just like your stomach contents can climb up into your mouth sometimes, and we've all experienced that. Well, poop and the level of bacteria that are in poop can get through this ileocecal valve and continually seed the small intestine. So that is something that can be really, really helpful. Another cheap trick is to use erythromycin at bedtime. I don't use this that often in patients with SIBO, but both the metoclopramide and the erythromycin are things that she probably could get her Medi-Cal doctor to order for her. Medicaid, so not Medi-Cal because you're out of the state. I'm thinking those are places to start. Certainly, what I call food zen is also a suggestion. And food zen means you don't read, listen to the news, or engage in any kind of upsetting thoughts if you can. You sit there, look at your food, smell your food, taste your food, roll your food around in your mouth, and you wait till you feel saliva show up in your mouth before you swallow. And you chew, chew, chew every bite, and it takes you longer to eat. So you end up getting more stimulation from the brain to get the digestive process rolling properly. And by all means, no antacids, no H2 blockers, nothing that reduces stomach acid. And God help her if she's on proton pump inhibitors. I didn't mention it, but that's one of the more common reasons that people develop SIBO. Now that when that stuff went over the counter, it turned out to be a very bad thing. And anyone who's a regular listener has heard me rail against proton pump inhibitors like omeprazole or Prilosec, so I'm not getting on that particular soapbox. I hope I've been able to help Christine's daughter with some of this advice. And I want to let you know that you can go to askdrdawn.com and subscribe to the podcast, which would be nice. But you can also listen to the archives where we have a lot of things, a lot of interviews in the archives, as well as previous shows. And we have a short description of the topics, which is really helpful when you're scanning. Let's do another email. This was a bit longer, but I'm trying to, let's just go for it. This is Tim in Santa Cruz. Health-destroying candida. Dear Dr. Dawn, I'll try to keep it as short as I can. I have a history of Kenalog, which is a steroid for eczema as a baby, and he underwent Achilles tendon surgery and was given antibiotics for an incision that wouldn't heal, and about a year later he developed digestive problems, and then he became sensitive to fragrances, alcohol, and caffeine. So someone diagnosed him with candida overgrowth about 1983, and we were just talking about why it's so important to look for fungus. And he had multiple fungi, and he had lots of high-level antibody tests, and he had organic acid tests in his urine, which proved that he had fungal overgrowth because he had high quantities of things that are physiologically only made by fungi. It's not going to be in your urine unless there's a lot of fungus in your gut making it. It's pretty definitive proof. So it's 2019. He has colon inflammation, no appetite, poor digestion. He's taking industrial strength Creon, which is pancreatic enzymes. He has fatigue and depression, chemical sensitivities, and he had a colonoscopy, which found lymphocytic colitis, which normally causes diarrhea. He was given some more steroids, and he was given omeprazole for esophagitis, which he didn't take, thank goodness, and he knows that it contributes to lymphocytic colitis. And it's been 35 years. And he's pretty sure he's got a drug-resistant fungi in his gut, and I think his diagnosis is pretty correct. So he's listening, and he's been taking herbs and probiotics, but the first thing you need to do, Tim, is figure out if this is colon only or whether you also have SIBO. So I really think it would be important for you to do a test called a breath test that the previous lady talked about. I think the antibiotics, just to tell your story, retell it quickly, I think the antibiotics for a long time messed up your microbiome, basically took out the guardians. And so opportunistic organisms that wouldn't have gotten across, past those guardians, got across, got their hooks in, and got established. And all those steroids over the years didn't help because they suppressed the immune system. But you've always probably had problems with stomach acid. So all the things I talked about with the earlier email also apply to you. I think you should add stomach acid, even if you're already taking the Creon. And I think that the reason that, you've got lymphocytic colitis is that your system is reacting against the bacteria that are in there. I wish bacteria and fungi that are in there. You really need to stay away from steroids. You really need to increase your stomach acid. The Reglan would be also a good, fairly benign idea. Reglan has this really scary warning that it's because it's related to the antipsychotic drugs, that it might cause tardive dyskinesia. But we used to give out, you know, 20 years ago, we used to give out a lot of Reglan, and we didn't see a lot of tardive dyskinesia. So I think the frequency of that side effect with this particular drug is pretty low. I typically use a half strength, 5 milligram, rather than the 10 milligram I was trained to use in medical school. And I don't worry about it because it does increase motility, and it's way more benign than the other drug that increases motility, which has actually been known to cause gangrene of the bowel. So we don't go there. There are some pro-motility things that you can do, but most of them would be a problem if you have SIBO. So get that breath test. I'm sure you know about anti-candida diets, but your multiple chemical sensitivity is probably due to the fact that you have a very leaky gut, and you probably have developed some mitochondrial toxicity. That's usually what the chemical sensitivities are from. They're from your cells just being tired, not being able to make enough energy to clear the backlog of things that are interfering with the function of the mitochondria. So I think what I would suggest, and I'm sorry if I sound like I'm blowing my own horn, but I think you need to be evaluated by someone who knows what they're doing. My office is over on Mission Street. You can link to it from AskDrDawn.com. Give us a call. We'll see if we can make it work for you, because this really is going to be a journey. And I don't think that there's any place online you're going to need the kind of guidance that a functional medicine physician can provide. So hope to be seeing you sometime in the next, little while. Let's go to our next news story. This is kind of, we've got some kind of fun short ones now for you. And this one is how weight training changes the brain. So we've talked about weight training for dementia, and particularly for Alzheimer's dementia. This is a fun little rat study where they showed that weight training actually really made a difference in rats who had a kind of chemically induced Alzheimer's-like condition related to brain inflammation. So they basically gave them a pro-inflammatory, got their brain inflamed, the mice got demented, and then they cured them with exercise. But I love how they did the exercise. They got about a 3 foot long, 1 meter long ladder, which it's 1 meter, so it tells you that it was, I'm impressed that it was done in America, but they used a meter, probably bought the ladder on eBay, and they got bags of weighted pellets, probably shot, buckshot, and taped them to the rat's butts. And then they stood at the top of the ladder and they held a Fruit Loop up, and the rat went, "Oh, Fruit Loop," and scurried up the ladder. And every time they did that, of course, they did some weightlifting. And after several weeks, they could show that the climbers had increased muscle mass. So they gave this inflammation to the brain. And then they began, they had a control group who didn't get the inflammatory substance. Then they got those to begin their weekly ladder scurry for the Fruit Loop. And they kept adding weights to their bags, and the rats kept gravely climbing up to get the Fruit Loop. And then after about 5 weeks, they took the rats and put them in this memory chamber. And basically, this is a brightly lit maze with one dark room in it, one little dark corner. And since rats like dark places, after several visits to the maze, they would figure out where the dark place was, and they'd head for that chamber immediately when released into the maze. But of course, the control animals were the fastest and most accurate, and the rodents with the mild cognitive impairments had a hard time. They just could not remember where that dark room was. It's like, damn, I know there's a dark room in here somewhere, but they weren't getting to it quickly. Now, the weight-trained animals were a little slower, but they caught up and in some cases got even better than the controls at finding the dark room. So the weight training, according to Mr. Kelty, who is a doctoral candidate, a PhD candidate at the University of Missouri, and who did the study, is that the weight training had effectively restored the ability of the rats to think. And so then they, of course, killed the rats and examined brain tissue from all of the groups. They found inflammation in the brains of the animals that had been injected, but in the weight training rats, they found enzymes and genetic markers that are known to help kickstart the creation and survival of new neurons and also increase neuroplasticity, which is your ability to form new synapses and remodel yourself. So basically, the weight trained rats were remaking themselves to be uninflamed and unimpaired. We've got data in humans as well, but I had to share with you the meter-long rat ladder and the Fruit Loop because I had a year doing rat research. It wasn't maze work, and I won't go into terrible details. You can go look up my article if you really want to know. It turns out it's there on the internet. The thing about these studies are humans are not rats. So you get something like this, you then want to do the data in the research in humans, and there is research in humans that shows exactly the same thing. So this is probably a mammal-wide effect. And my advice to all of my patients, and I see quite a lot of people for a Bredesen support protocol. He's the guy who wrote the book The End of Alzheimer's, and he put together a program, which we do at my office, and people need to lift weights. If you do nothing else to improve your mind as you age, you need to lift weights, get that 20 minutes of walking, moderate exercise daily, and learn something new that involves seeing, hearing, and moving some kind of muscle, whether it's learning to play the piano or some other musical instrument or learning to speak a new language. It is putting stuff in through your eyes and ears and sending it out into the muscles that causes your brain to be all the strings in your brain to be pulled. And somehow when you pull all of those strings, you stimulate synapses. Just getting better at something that you already know, just reading books when you're already a good reader, it's fun, it's recreational, but it doesn't improve your mind. I'm not even sure that crossword puzzles, which I know are a fetish with people, I don't think those are going to work unless you go and get like elementary school level crossword puzzles in Spanish and or French or whatever language you want and start doing those. And that would probably work beautifully. We're going to go ahead and move to our next story. This one is brief, but that's good. Turns out you don't need to take 10 days of antibiotics if you get pneumonia. This was a study looking at, and how long do we really need to treat people? And the shortest effective guideline-defined duration in this study was 5 days for community-acquired pneumonia and 7 days if you got your pneumonia in the hospital. So less therapy for people with pneumonia, just a much shorter duration worked just as well and reduced the excess, well, the antibiotic-associated adverse events, which would be things like diarrhea, SIBO, chronic inflammatory bowel disease, and all of the other fun. And also the study basically says we've been treating for too long, our drugs are really good now, and we need to do a briefer period. And also, along the same lines, COPD exacerbations. So when a person with, say, chronic emphysema shows up and you say, chronic emphysema, and they're coughing and they've got a sputum color change, automatic antibiotics. That's how I was taught. Turns out, check a CRP, C-reactive protein. It's an inflammatory molecule. Ask your doctor to do this if you have asthma or chronic bronchitis. If your CRP is greater than 40, take the antibiotics. If it's less than 20, don't. We're going to our first caller.
Sure.
What can I do for you?
Well, I'm a new listener, and I'm really enjoying the show. Thank you so much for doing what you're doing. Specifically, though, I've been hearing a lot lately, science is always learning. So I've been hearing a lot lately about the NRF2 pathway, mm-hmm. and that activating it is important. Do you have any thoughts or opinions or knowledge about that you could share?
Sure. Think about yin and yang, right? So NRF2 is the yin, in other words, calm, cool, to the yang of tumor necrosis factor, which does exactly what it sounds like it does. It goes out and shoots cancers. It's like the Rambo chemical. It activates the immune system. It upregulates all the inflammatory markers, produces all the cytokines, all the things that make this happen are there. And so in the NRF2 pathway, you have the things that prevent that from happening. So it damps down the cascade of inflammation. And that is effectively, they're both important. We need to be able to inflame to fight off bacteria, for example, and also to fight off cancers. And a lot of the autoimmune drugs are blocking the tumor necrosis factor, like all of the rheumatoid arthritis drugs, Enbrel, Remicade, and the ones you see on TV all the time because it's a bigger market, all the psoriasis applications. And they're throwing a ton of money at that because psoriasis is a bigger market, even though, in my opinion, it's an inappropriate disease to treat because unless the person has psoriatic arthritis, it's cosmetic. Yet what you're getting for that is you're turning off tumor necrosis factor. And after about 10 years on the stuff, yeah, you start to see more leukemia and more lymphoma. And, we haven't probably been giving it long enough to see all the other cancers, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's a general, well, effectively carcinogen to turn off tumor necrosis factor. We'd like to do it a little more nuanced, and it would be lovely to just use natural methods or turn up NRF, and that's a holy grail right now. I don't believe that there are, I'm sure there are drugs in development, but I haven't seen any research or anything showing what they are or that anything is anywhere near coming to market. Plus, once it comes to market, we're still going to have to wait 5 years to see what the joker in the deck might be.
Sure.
Follow-up question.
I understand that there is actually a pharmaceutical now on the market, but there's some natural things out there that are actually outdoing it. So,
what would those be?
I take Protandim every day. I've been taking for almost 4 years now. I had a cranial resection that after that, I discovered it pretty quickly and swear by it, and I help a lot of people out. If you want more information, I'd love to share it privately with you. But
are you in any way financially involved with the organization that makes it? Please be honest.
Of course I am. Of course I am now.
Okay.
I'm not going to pitch that to your listeners, but you've been very informative about the yin and yang, and that actually makes way more sense to me. And I do take a small natural dose a day, and I know that even black pepper can accomplish simple things like that. So, do you have any opinion about?
I think I've lost you. All right. Well, we're going to try our other caller, and that one is Claude. And Claude, let's see if I get you here. Hello, Claude, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm on the phone.
What have you got?
So I had to take a course of that antibiotics for some dental work, and so I was just curious of what is the best way to rebuild my microbiome. I mean, I'm pretty conscious about what I eat. I eat a lot of yogurt, and now it's prunes and figs and oat bran and yogurt and all the other stuff, and I was just curious if you have any suggestions on rebuilding.
Definitely. Okay, so let's talk rebuilding the microbiome. Gut gardening, 101. So you've had a little brush fire, and all of your flowers have burnt to the ground, and you're basically dealing with wanting things to sprout from the roots, but meanwhile have a problem with basically airborne seeds that are going to land on that nice fertile field and take root before the slower growing plants that you had intended to regrow there have a chance to get established. We call those weeds. And in fact, a dysbiosis is exactly that. It's weeds. I like the yogurt. I think you should also be doing sauerkraut or kimchi or some other form of non-pasteurized fermented vegetable. And and there are a couple of foods that are kind of miracle regrow the gut foods. One of them is apples, and we covered this on the show, I think it was a couple weeks ago, but different kinds of apples. So you go to the store and you buy each week, you know, one of each kind of organic apple they've got, and you eat it and throw it in the smoothie. If you do throw it in the blender, eat the core. Turns out the core has lots of good bacteria in it, and that's what you're trying to do. Is get as broad a range of infused food bacteria as you can. And that also means root vegetables. So juicing carrots, juicing beets, you can't really juice potatoes, but you can eat potatoes. And it turns out you can't really kill all the bacteria in a sweet potato by cooking it. So go ahead and besides, even if you do manage to sterilize the thing, there is there are spores that will regrow, and it's very hard to kill spores. So we don't generally, and they resprout in our gut. And the types of soil bacteria that really make up our microbiome, a lot of them are anaerobic, and so they're hidden inside these foods. So we can't grow them. When you buy probiotics at the store, you're not getting 90% of what we know is supposed to be in there, because we can only really culture the aerobic stuff. It's really hard to grow the anaerobes, so we don't try as a supplement. But it's a natural supplement. It's waiting out there, just in the garden, everywhere. As many different kinds of root vegetables as you can. So you know the rutabaga and the turnip, and it's like kohlrabi. And what is this stuff? Yeah, that's the stuff. Learn to make soup, warm green smoothie. Great way to get yourself some of the good stuff. And the more plants that you eat and the greater the variety, this makes a difference in terms of repopulating your microbiome. For place holding, I would take a good general probiotic. Claire, Klaire, makes one called Pro 5. They make a Therabiotic Complete, which is about as broad a variety as you can get. Jaro has a good product. They have a ton of products. I like Ultradophilus. Don't take VSL-70. Don't take one of these super, super potent ones where you're getting 500 billion organisms or something insane like that, unless you're very sure that you have adequate stomach acid and no risk factors for SIBO. And I don't know whether you started listening to the show at the beginning, but we've covered those risk factors for SIBO fairly thoroughly, so I'm not going to go over them again.
Okay, well, I've got plenty of information now. I really appreciate that, and it's been very helpful. So I'm going to go back to making my soup, even though it's summertime. Soup is for wintertime, but now I'll go get some vegetables and start cooking it up.
Well, you know, in tropical countries, they drink hot tea because it makes them sweat, and then they feel cooler. So hopefully you'll get the same result. Happy gardening.
Yes, thank you.
Bye-bye. In the short run, we're going to jump to some really cool short stories that I'm glad to have a chance to get through this week. Let's start with global warming. We've covered yeast and candida. How about a
Let's talk about the new candida on the block, Candida auris, which can cause severe illness with people with a weakened immune system. Cases of C. auris have been diagnosed around the world. Started out a decade ago in Japan with an ear infection. But the weird thing is this fungus showed up across the world all at once. India, U.S., South Africa. And typically humans, by the way, get fungus in cooler parts of their body, feet and fingers. And so they think what happened is that the fungus, Candida auris, adapted to warmer environments, and now it's growing inside our bodies. So this has got us, got people a little bit worried, as you might imagine. How are we going to kill this stuff? I don't see anything in this article about what its sensitivity is or whether it's an issue, but yeah, new and emerging diseases and new and emerging locations, always fun. Makes you want to go and dust off the, what was the pathology book? Robinson Cotran and Harrison's textbook of internal medicine and the London School of Tropical Medicine book, whose author I don't remember, was also very good. So, on the subject of global warming, let's talk about a surge in eastern equine encephalitis in Florida. Now, this is showing up in sentinel chickens, which, I don't know, somehow the word sentinel and the word chicken just don't work. It's funny. But these are birds that are regularly tested for West Nile and the eastern equine encephalitis. And the risk has of getting this has gone up. They're finding these mosquitoes in New York State, Massachusetts. It's a fairly rare disease right now. It is a brain virus. About 30% of cases are fatal. There's really not any treatment for it. So my advice, and this is also for all those other lovely mosquito vector-borne diseases, which, we're in a tourist area. So somebody with malaria could actually be walking around in your neighborhood, someone with dengue, likewise. And what happens? Well, the mosquito bites them, then it bites you, and you win. You get to be written up in the medical morbidity and mortality report. Well, hopefully you don't die, but just saying. Go out now. Do mosquito patrol. Right now, this weekend, get yourself out there. Look for water. Turn the garden pots over. Walk around the mosquitoes, by the way, if you do like a good 100 feet around your house, to be safe, 300, call it 100 yards. But if you just clear 100 feet, most of the time, that's more than adequate to keep your risk of mosquito bites at home, at least, down. I just see the headline for this. Secret Cuban ray gun damages brains of embassy staff. Do you remember a few years ago, government workers claimed that they were being subjected to sonic attacks at the U.S. Embassy in Havana, and it was about 2016. Dozens of diplomats and people who worked at the embassy started hearing strange high-pitched sounds and began having dizziness, headaches, and hearing problems. And people were thought, well, maybe they're being blasted with some kind of weapon, or maybe this is mass hysteria. We always, when we don't understand something, that this is a doctor reflex, reflex. We say, oh, well, let's put hysteria on the thing because then I don't feel so stupid. And my motto is the patient's telling the truth. They're telling their truth as they see it. The only exception to that is drug seeking, but for the most part, they're telling a different story. When they talk about their pain there, it's a different kind of pain. But if you believe the patient, then your job as the doctor is to figure out how to help them, not dismiss them as hysterical or, sorry, not my table. This sounds like an endocrine problem, and I'm a neurologist. Not okay. So, researchers at the University of Pennsylvania decided to do MRI scans on 40 of the victims. They compared them to a control group. Guess what? Their brains were completely different from anything that anybody has ever seen. They had less white matter across their whole brain. White matter, that's the insulation on your cognitive connections. Less connectivity in the regions involved in hearing and vision. It doesn't resemble any specific disorder that's ever been seen before on MRI. And all you can say, says the author of the study, something happened which caused their brains to change. And many of these people are altered for life, and we don't know what did it. It happened to people in Cuba, and I just wonder who else has this, who else might have this weapon? What do you think? Oh, well, that's a kind of scary meme to leave you on. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.